is the Florida Spectacular Podcast with your hosts, Kathy Silustri and Rick Kilby. Keep up with Kathy at greatfloridaroadtrip.com and on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Silustri. Find Rick at rickkilby.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to this week's episode of Florida Spectacular. Good morning, Rick. How are you?
I'm great. I actually took a walk on the beach this morning, and every time I come to the beach, it's like, why do I live in Florida and not go to the beach often enough? It's, you know, one of the reasons people move here, and it's just such a great way to start your day.
You're landlocked where you live.
That's true. That's true. So, I mean, except for lakes and stuff and, you know, places with alligators and such.
Alligators are very sweet. Leave them alone.
I'm giving you a segue.
Well, no, I want to just go back and remind everybody you're in St. Augustine this week. And before we move on to our guest in today's topic, what have you been doing? Is there anything people should do in St. Augustine? Anything new to you?
So far, we have not left Volano Beach, which it's a great little beach town. We went to Caps on the Water, which is a great restaurant. I love the way they've kind of incorporated the trees there into the deck, and you sit outside and there's these, it's just spectacular and watch the sunset. One of my favorite places to go. And then I'm right across from that, whatever, it's Magic Something Motel that they're about to tear down. It's, you know, got this wonderful neon and these beautiful flamingo inlays. I think it was probably built in the 50s or 60s, although it looks older than that because it's very deco-like. And it's about to go by the wayside, and it's another piece of old Florida that we're about to lose, which breaks my heart.
It's okay. There'll be more old Florida soon. We're getting older every day.
That's true. We're bringing the old Florida.
I'm trying to make you feel better. But you mentioned gators because you said you were giving me a segue, and I feel like you have a very definite path in mind here. I was going to talk more about how we've had some wonderful rain this week, and it's given me plenty of time to sit and binge watch things on my streaming services. But you can go with gators if you want.
Well, the thing we're talking about, I think it was promoted heavily with the gator side of it, but I really don't think that's the main part of the story. But our guest can tell us more.
And we don't want to promote gator haters.
No, definitely not. Because it turns out that wasn't really part of the story anyways.
Right. So the gators were blameless.
Yes.
Okay. Maybe we should tell people what the story is. So we have a guest today who is an author who has written a book called Guilty Creatures. And then it has been turned into, I guess you would call it, a mini series on Hulu called Mr. and Mrs. Murder, which sounds very formal and fancy. But we'll let our guest tell us about it. Makita Brotman is the author. Good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, how did you find this particular crime? How did this attract your attention?
Well, I'm a big fan of court TV, and I've been a true crime fan all my life. And I'm particularly interested in very unusual cases. And I'm also a psychoanalyst, and I'm really interested in cases that have something that are more than just a lurid story, you know, that have some kind of psychological depth to them. And I'm also a lover of Florida. So any case that takes place in Florida is a good opportunity for me to come to Florida. And I listened to the last week's podcast on alligators, and I too am a big alligator lover. And so, like you said, the alligators were kind of the alibi in this case that sort of disappeared. Yeah. But still, I think, you know, for people reading about true crime in Florida, having an alligator punchline in the story is an extra incentive.
Okay.
I have so many questions.
Yeah, I go ahead, Rick, you start.
So, Makita, first of all, tell us, where are you from and where are you now? Because you definitely don't sound like you're from Florida.
No, I'm from Sheffield in the north of England. And I've been living in Baltimore for the last 25 years, which has just been designated a hellhole by Trump this week. But it's a very beautiful place, actually.
And so how did you hear about this story? How did you first find out about it?
Well, like I said, I'm very interested in court TV. And I watched the trial on court TV. I watched the testimony of Brian Winchester, who's an important figure in the case and was just kind of riveted by it. And I wanted to know all I could about the story.
So do you want to, you maybe, can you take us through, because we're being very kind of walking around the details of the case with not telling people the whole story. And it's, you know, Kathy and I think both watched the docuseries on it.
Oh, yeah.
How many episodes was it? They stretched it out. And but it, you know, it took place over a number of years. So that worked.
Let's tell the story briefly.
Yeah, tell the story.
Maybe
tell
we
the
should
story.
Do that.
Makita, it's all yours.
Yes.
Okay. So basically the setting is in Tallahassee in the 1990s. And we have two couples, Mike and Denise Williams and Kathy and Brian Winchester. And they were both born and raised in very strict Baptist families in a Baptist community. And they've known each other forever. They went to middle school together and high school together. And the two couples marry. They stay very close friends. But after the marriage, things start to change for a while. So it's as though they kind of have discovered that after marriage, that life is not all that they thought it was. And they've, you know, repressed their sexuality and they've been virgins before marriage and, you know, never experimented. And after the marriage, there's this period where they start to experiment with drugs and strippers and, you know, unconventional sex and so on. And it happens that Brian and Denise, so the man from one couple and the woman from the other couple, fall in love and start to have an affair. But pretty soon their guilt affects them and they return to the church. But eventually they realize that they do want to be together. But rather than doing what anyone else would do and filing for divorce for various reasons, including their religion and the public appearance and appearance of morality, they begin to plot to murder Mike. And
as Jesus would do, right? As the church.
Right. And it's also significant that Brian is an insurance salesman. And while Mike is still alive, he encourages Mike to undertake a number of insurance policies. So that's a significant part of the case. So they've re-embraced the church. They justify the murder to each other by describing it as a test of whether God actually wants them to be together or not. So both Brian and Mike are big duck hunters. And the test is this, that Brian will push Mike overboard while they're duck hunting. And they believe that when someone's in the water, when they're wearing waders, the waders will fill up with water and they'll drown. So this occurs. Mike passes the test. In other words, that Brian and God means Brian and Denise to be together. Brian never returns. His body never surfaces. Everyone assumes that he's been eaten by alligators. And it's only much, much later that we learn what happens on the lake. Only Brian knows. So Brian and Kathy get divorced. Brian marries Denise. And actually, the murder stays hidden for the next 16 years. Although, of course, the community is completely suspicious. And is what interests me is not the crime itself, although just briefly what happened on the lake was that Mike fell in the water. His waders did not fill up with water. He did not drown. Brian has to end up shooting him in the head, dragging the body to land, driving it to a different point in Tallahassee, Gardner Lake, burying it there, and it stays buried for 16 years. So the story to me, what really interests me is not the crime itself, but those 16 years. You know, how does that couple live with the knowledge that they have committed this terrible murder, especially when they're committed Baptist? You know, how do they justify it? How do they go to church every week, go to the PTA, coach football, you know, live very virtuous Baptist lives, knowing that they have this murder on their soul? So I wanted to explore the psychology of this couple, the different ways that they defend themselves against guilt through all these years, this sort of astonishing range of psychological manipulations and maneuverings and justifications and denials, and their relationship with one another, which begins as this completely united devotion and then turns to concealment at all costs, and how the murder bears down on them during their life, and how they're driven in different directions and then back together again and then apart again. So at different times during those 16 years, one of them might bear the guilt, and then the guilt is then unloaded onto the other one, and this sort of terrible burden moves back and forth, always unconsciously, really, and, you know, how they squared it with their religion. And then in the end, Brian, after 16 years, Brian starts taking refuge in drugs and alcohol again because the guilt gets too much for him. Denise kind of goes into the state of repression where I think she really believes that she had nothing to do with Mike's death. And what's another thing that's so interesting to me about the case is that, I mean, I think it's something that we can all relate to. I mean, most of us haven't committed murder, but we've all done terrible things that we regret, and we've got secrets that we keep hidden, and we keep secrets from our partners and our families, and we experience denial, and we experience our own psychological maneuverings. So in a way, it's like ordinary human psychology, but writ large, so that we can just, you know, distance ourselves from it, but also become fascinated by it and relate to it. So it's not, you know, to me, the story is not just about Brian and Denise. It's about sort of how human psychology works.
Wow.
So do you really think, I mean, you really believe that by the end, she did not, she had convinced herself she had nothing to do with that murder?
I think, I don't think she did know what happened. I think she agreed to this test. She agreed, and implicitly, you know, she kind of knew that Mike would be killed. But beyond that, she didn't know what actually, I mean, Brian admitted she didn't actually know what happened on the lake. So I think over the years, she probably converted that lack of knowledge into an idea that, well, you know, Brian did something, but it was on his own agency, and I really had nothing to do with it. And I think she converted that into the idea that she was innocent. But of course, you know, deep down, I think, of course, she must have realized her guilt.
That was, to me, the biggest question I took away was, how do those two people live with themselves for all those years? And I, you know, at least the documentary kind of paints Brian as kind of not a good guy. And you could, you know, you get the idea that he was just a jerk. Whereas Denise, you know, I like how she lived with it. And, you know, the other thing they like, so there were kids involved. So Brian and Denise don't they end up raising Mike's kid?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so she, I think it's a girl, right? She ends up being raised by the people that murdered her father.
That's right. Yeah.
And that's a whole other thing. Like I think about that poor girl, and just, I hope she's in therapy. That's all I can say. 'Cause that's so much to deal with and unpack and try to deal with as an adult. 'Cause I think she's an adult by now.
Well, she is. And she completely stands by her mother. And so the way, I mean, true crime does this a lot, to pit people against each other in kind of binaries. So there's the bad guys and the good guys. Now, you know, nobody's completely innocent. Nobody's completely guilty. And I think that by making Brian into this evil monster that corrupted her mother and murdered her father, I think that must be one way of dealing with it, because we, you know, we come to terms with things in our own way, even things that are very, very disturbing. And at the end of the trial, when Denise, both were found guilty, and Denise actually got a longer sentence than Brian because Brian took a deal and told them everything. So Denise's attorney talked about something with me. He talked about something that he called the Eve factor. And he says, when a man and woman face a crime together that they've committed together, it's generally the Eve who believes to have seduced the Adam. So it often happens that lovers will plot to kill the wife's husband or the husband's wife. And even though the woman might be involved in the planning of the murder, like Denise, it's almost always the man who carries it out. And yet the woman is punished equally, if not more so, with Denise. And unlike her co-conspirator, she's sort of stigmatized sexually and scorned and ridiculed and described as like a black widow or a Jezebel. And in this case, because Brian took a plea deal, you know, somebody had to be punished. Somebody had to satisfy this social need for blame. And the only person left was Denise. And of course, you know, Mike's mother had spent basically 15 years looking desperately for Mike. And she was she's a very, very sympathetic person. And someone had to, you know, had to bear the brunt of her pain. And so I think socially, Denise was the scapegoat. I mean, she was involved in the murder, of course, but there's also something broader going on to do with society and culture and a society's psychological need for justice as well.
You almost do have to wonder the way, especially in the miniseries, the way they position Brian, it almost, you can obviously speak to this much more eloquently than I can. It was almost a sense of him always being not as accepted. And then it showed a very cruel pattern of behavior. And, you know, I was definitely left wondering how much manipulation was there on his part, too. And I'm not excusing her at all, because if you say, yes, I want my husband dead, go for it. And you're already stepping out on him with somebody who, you know, is willing to do it for you. There's certainly an amount of culpability there. But I do wonder how much emotional and sexual manipulation there was there.
You mean Denise manipulating Brian or the other way around?
He manipulating her.
Yeah. One of the reasons there's so much stigma against Denise is that Brian testified at trial and Denise didn't. So Denise remains this kind of blank, this kind of cipher, whereas we heard everything about Brian's experiences, the horror of the murder, his refuge in drugs and porn and so on.
Well, we heard his version of it.
Yeah, we heard his version of it, but it was the version that he told to the state in order for this deal to take place. So if anything of that was untrue, his deal would be off. And he told it numerous times and the police, you know, tracked down the body and everything kind of fit together. But in the miniseries, we have Kathy, Brian's ex-wife, who's telling the story, basically. And it's really fascinating to get her perspective on things because, yes, her depiction of Brian as this, like, lazy, kind of sex-driven, manipulative figure fits with the way Denise described him, too. So I certainly think, you know, Denise was not a weak person. I mean, I don't think she's someone who would be easily manipulated. And I think in a couple, the dynamics of a couple, it always kind of goes back and forth. I mean, each has ways to manipulate the other. So I don't know if you can, you know, say that this occurred because Brian manipulated Denise or the other way around. I mean, Denise certainly had a lot of, you know, she's very sexually charismatic and I think very seductive. And I think Brian was partly kind of obsessed with her in some ways.
Kathy was one of the more interesting people in the story, at least in the documentary, because, you know, she comes off first like she was, you know, wounded by what Brian did. But then she's like, I did it. I caught them, you know, because she wears a wire and tries to get Denise to admit all this stuff.
She was not a sympathetic character to me.
I her vindictiveness turned me off a little bit, but I also found her intriguing. Like, you know, I don't know. What did you think about her, Makita?
I think because she's the focus of the show. Actually, Kathy, you know, I didn't talk to Kathy, and Kathy was very distant from this whole thing. She wanted nothing to do with it. She remarried. She went and lived in a different state. But having now her coming out and telling her side of the story was really fascinating. I do think, you know, the idea that she solved the case is a little bit of an exaggeration. I mean,
yeah.
Mike's mother didn't appear in the miniseries, which kind of confused me because she's also, I mean, she's spoken a lot to the media. She's very elderly now, but she also had an enormous role in solving this case. I mean, she never let it drop. She's the one who got the police to open an investigation into the case. She constantly put up posters with Mike's picture on them. She had Mike's picture on a picket that she would petition outside the churches. She would constantly ask the police what was going on. She wrote to the governor many, many times. She got involved with Jennifer Portman, who's a journalist from the Tallahassee Democrat, who also had an important role in solving the case because she every year would publish an article, wouldn't let it drop, and kept the case in the public eye. But ultimately, the case would not have been solved if Brian and Denise had not turned on each other. You know, they were the ones that destroyed themselves in the end. There was nothing that the police or the public could do if one of them, if as long as they kept quiet. And it was the fact that, you know, Brian ultimately turned on Denise, that they, the pressure caused the situation to implode is what. So there's a combination of things that finally brought them to justice. I don't think it was just Kathy wearing the wire, although that was an important part.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's a big secret to keep. I keep flashing back when I think about this whole story. Did you ever see the movie Body Heat? There's a quote in it. I'm going to get it wrong, but it's something like, if you're going to kill somebody, there's 1,000 ways something can go wrong. And if you can think of 10 of them, you're doing good. Like, it's too much. I'm always amazed when a case goes cold forever, because it just feels like it's a lot of, two people can keep a secret if one of them is dead. Isn't that the song? Like, it's a big secret to keep.
But they came so close to getting away with it. That's the thing. If
not for those meddling kids.
Yeah. I mean, if he'd hadn't turned on her, they would have got away. I mean, they got away with it for 16 years.
Yeah. And I think that comparing it with Body Heat is interesting, because another thing that drew me to the case is that it has all these uncanny literary references. So it's basically the story of Macbeth. You know, a couple get together to commit a murder for their own social position without realizing how it's going to come back and haunt them eventually, and destroying their relationship, which is what happens in Macbeth. So Lady Macbeth is the one in charge, the aggressive one, and Macbeth is reluctant, but over time their position changes, and it's Lady Macbeth who can't bear the guilt, and Macbeth goes into deep denial. And there's also echoes of classical drama like the Oresteia, classical figures like the Avenging Mother. But I don't know if you're familiar with the movie and the novel Double Indemnity, but it's also a version of that. You know, this is a noir novel by James R. Cain, which is, most people might be more familiar with the movie with Edward G. Robinson and Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck. But in this story, it's a woman who persuades her insurance sale lover to kill her husband. And there are other stories by James Cain and Raymond Chandler, these like noir stories that often have, you know, very similar resonances. And the mood too strikes me as very like noir and gothic. There's a kind of genre of Florida gothic, which I think this fits into. So again, to me, it has so many wider resonances than just like a lurid true crime story.
One of my other questions is, why did Mike's mom not accept the official line that it was alligators that did it? You know, that he died duck hunting and alligators ate his body, because she never believed it for some reason. And it seemed like a lot of people just accepted that. And that's why, you know, I imagine there were people telling her all the time to just get over it. You know, your son was eaten by alligators and just move on. Why did she, was it some kind of, you think she had some kind of instinct that he didn't actually, you know, in that way? Or because that's one of the things I wondered. Because I do think they didn't give her a big enough role in the documentary, that she, you know, she fought and fought and fought to keep his case from being ignored.
Yeah, I wondered that too, because when I talked to her to the book, she was very, very eager to talk, and she wanted to get Mike's story out there. But when the book came out, she didn't like it, and she didn't like the depiction of her, which I thought was very sympathetic. So maybe for that reason, she didn't take part in the documentary, that she felt that she didn't like the depiction of her, or felt that she was more involved than she was made out to be. But it's interesting that one of the people who kept trying to get her to shut up was Denise. And Denise finally used this terrible tactic of not allowing Cheryl ever to see her granddaughter again. Denise said to her, you know, if you keep on trying to get Mike's case in the media, I won't let you see your granddaughter. And she eventually did that. And they've been, you know, they haven't seen each other ever since then. But the thing about alligators is really interesting, because one of the things that Cheryl did was do all this research on alligators, and she discovered that they don't eat in the winter. And this crime took place in December. And She spoke to a lot of alligator biologists, and apparently they go into the state called brumation in the winter, where they're kind of sluggish and they don't really need to eat. So the idea of someone being eaten by alligators, I mean, the theory was that Mike drowned and then his body was eaten by alligators. So
right.
Like they attacked him alive. But everybody said, you know, his body will surface in the spring when the water warms up. And when it didn't, that was one of the reasons when Cheryl became very concerned and suspicious. But also Cheryl was extremely religious, and religious in a way, like she's not a church-going Baptist, but she sort of believed in like signals and signs and sort of the occult in a way. And she talked to psychics and fortune tellers. And she said that God told her that Mike was not in the lake. And she went to the lake and she said she had this revelation from God that Mike was not in the lake. And that's what spurred her struggle. She actually believed that he was still alive and had gone, you know, something had happened to him, like perhaps that he had discovered that Denise's child, his child was not his, was Brian's, and something had spurred him to leave, or he'd had an accident and he'd lost his memory or something. But she was convinced that he was not dead in the lake. And it turned out she was right.
Creepy.
It's a lot.
It was thoroughly enjoyable, though. If you're listening, and I know you are because you can hear me talking, go buy Guilty Creatures. And if you have Hulu, it's definitely not an exhaustive, you know, made-for-TV adaptation type things are never as good as the book. At least that's what I believe. But Hulu is Mr. and Mrs. Murder.
What I'm getting from Makita is there's a whole other layer that the television series didn't get to, and that's
yeah. I don't even think the television series mentioned the gunshot, did it? I'm trying to remember now.
Oh, that he shot him after he tried to drown him.
No.
They tell you when Mike does his you know, his big
Brian. Yeah.
Brian, you know, when he tells his story, they tell that. I mean, he has to swim or paddle over to him or motor over to him and get right up to him. And, you know, he waits and waits and waits and think, because one of the things they said in the documentary is he wasn't a good swimmer. And I think Brian was hoping the Mike would just kind of run out of steam and drown. But he got over to like a stump or something, was holding on to it.
Yeah.
So, and it sounds like he had to get really close to him to shoot him, which is just horrifying.
Yeah, and he lived with that for 16 years. He could, his best friend. That's a cheerful note, I think.
Yeah, well, really. The other thing I'm interested in is, like, bring us up to date. Brian's mom is still with us, but she's elderly, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then his daughter is, like, an adult now?
I know. Yeah, I'm surprised. I was reluctant to talk very much about the children in this story. Because,
yeah, I understand.
Her daughter is an adult and Brian's son is a teenager. And Brian is serving 20 years.
Wow.
And Denise is serving 30. So, you know, Brian will be out long before Denise. So they were both about 50 when they went to prison. So, you know, presumably they'll both be out at some point. So I know that their sentences, you know, in Florida can't be, you can get a little time for good behavior, but not very much. Mm. And if I have time, I just wanted to mention that, the Florida angle, which we haven't really talked about very much. And I start the book by talking about, you know, there's something about Florida and crime that kind of goes together. And I start the book by talking about how, like, the early explorers of Florida, like John Muir, were kind of fascinated by the heat and the foliage and the wildlife, but also this sense of like sluggishness that they were afraid might simulate moral laxity and moral apathy. And I think people still kind of believe that about something about the atmosphere and the swampiness and the flatness and the idea that, you know, that there are all these things that are repressed beneath the surface, like alligators. And then, of course, Florida has these very lax sunshine laws, which allow greater public access to Freedom of Information Act documents. So I think it's also that Florida cases just get much more publicity and that trials get live streamed and so on, just because of that, just because there's more opportunity to do so.
that's definitely true. It's easier to find things in Florida.
Yeah.
So,
and I think the Florida man trope has caught the imagination of the country, and it just kind of gets exploited. And it, you know, if you looked under a microscope at any state, you can find examples of weird extreme behavior. You know, I think you could argue Maine is it's just as weird as Florida. If you dug a little deeper, but I mean, on the other hand, you know, Florida is wacky sometimes.
Well, everybody comes here to run away. Not that this was the case with either of these people, but everybody comes away to reinvent themselves. And the problem is when you escape to paradise to leave your past behind, you're still you.
Yeah. And I do think, you know, the whole thing, when you look at the preview for the documentary, they really dug into the alligator part. And I think that's just low hanging fruit. You know, it makes it kind of sexy, you know, like an alligator got him. But, you know, alligator death roll, did he really survive? And it's like, that was kind of the hook they tried to lure people in. But to me, then I came away with this whole weird thing about religion, about how, you know, that they justified killing their spouse and not their spouse, but, you know, their best friend, because of a religious angle, and this how strange that was. And that was kind of the bigger thing, but they lured you in with the alligator, which seems to me like, you know, the whole Fountain of Youth thing, where it's like a trope that people find and eventually they come to, and, you know, you find all this stuff written and they take that angle because it's just easy. And I think that's where the alligator came in.
Yeah. And I didn't have much choice in the way that the book was marketed, but you know, that there's actually an alligator on the cover. It's from the bottom. I don't know if you can see it, but and they wanted
he's walking away, right?
Yeah, yeah. And they wanted me to have Florida in the title too, so that, you know, like I imagine, like search engines will pick up Florida and alligator. And but I've just been 6 months in New Orleans and seeing a lot of alligators, and I love them. They're much more frightened of us than we are of them, and they're very gentle, peaceful creatures, it seems to me. You know, someone gets eaten by an alligator or attacked by an alligator, and it's like headline news.
Yeah.
And it happens like every couple of years.
Usually some extenuating circumstances there. You're right. They are very peaceful, reclusive creatures. And I call them swamp puppies. I am if you listen to the podcast from 2 weeks ago, yes, that's definitely, I'm a big advocate for alligators. But I like the cover of the book. I think it's beautiful.
Yeah, I like it too. I mean, that's the kind of noir angle that I wanted to get, the like seedy motel and the darker side of Florida, the sort of abandoned side, but also incredibly bright and colorful, which I also really liked.
I got to find the book cover because I'm not seeing it. You know, the other thing I was just going to add about alligators is, and I just got that from Kathy's background on Zoom, is actually alligators is, because they are so much like dinosaurs that there's kind of a timelessness when you're seeing one, like you're crossing through time to look at this ancient creature. And I kind of feel the same way about gar and all these ancient creatures that are survived for years and years and years. When you look at them, you're kind of crossing through time because these are creatures that have been along, you know, long time before us, or at least there's a connection. And there's kind of something mystical about it.
Yeah,
at least from my perspective.
That's what I mean by the return of the repressed. There are all these things under the water that have been there for like hundreds and hundreds of years that are related to us. You know, they're kind of the dark repressed parts of ourselves that resurface.
That's a good place to stop.
I think so. That's pretty. Makita, thank you for being on the podcast today. And I hope that we get to see what you write next.
Well, it's another Florida case, actually.
Oh, boy.
Really? Oh, well, do you have a moment to tell us about
it? Yeah, give us a hint.
No, I want to keep it under my hat.
Okay. Okay.
Well, so is it true crime, though?
Yeah, it's true crime.
Oh.
Okay. Well, let us know when it's ready.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. If you're in Florida, let us know. We both have fonts of knowledge in different areas of the state.
Yes. And I just can't imagine what crime it could be. Anyway. Before we go, I want to definitely thank our listeners, but we have a question, Rick, and this one is definitely in your wheelhouse. It's from a reader, one of my readers, Christina Buchanan. She wants to know, would you please recommend a good guidebook to explore Florida Springs? My husband and I plan to explore Florida Springs this coming spring and many of the national parks throughout the next summer. Do you have a favorite book or two to use as a planning guide?
So I know Falcon came out with a book recently, or not that recently. Falcon is a publisher, but I think the definitive book is Doug Stamm's book. And he came out with a new edition within the last couple of years. It's STAMM. And it has kind of the science and hydrogeology and all that kind of stuff, the environmental aspects of springs, but also, you know, has a guide to some of those. And I would recommend that. It has beautiful images as well. It's full color throughout. And, it, you know, he's been at it for a long time. Springs kind of got popular, you know, about the time my first book came out in 2013. And so a lot of people kind of jumped on the bandwagon. I think it correlated with the time people got, you know, underwater cameras and started Instagram came around and people started taking pictures of springs. They got very hot. But Doug Stamm has been at it longer in his book. To me is the definitive book that, you know, I haven't found like the quintessential guidebook, but that's as close as I know of.
All right. So we want to thank our active supporters. You can also support us. Just click that support button on the Buzzsprout site. Stephanie Hewley, Brad Sager, Brian Woodall, Bets Boys Adventure, Elise Smith, Carol Miller, Leslie Hallweg, Davida Breyer, Natalie Zacharick, Angela Connolly, John Bowne, Ryan Worthington, and Michael Gargalak. And real quick, Rick, I want to let you know that book that we both love by Shanna Smith, Islands of Cedar. For all of our top level podcast supporters, we're going to be sending out a copy of that. And anybody who joins us new as a top level will get that until we run out. So
that's a great
time to support. Yes, it is.
It's such a fun read. I mean, it's a serious topic, but you know, it's enjoyable. It's a page turner. It has something, you know, like the environmental aspect of it, the history aspect of it. And, you know, it's a novel. So that's a great gift. Thanks for doing
that. Yeah. Well, I talked to Shannon. We had an event this weekend. So we talked about it. And I said, you know, I'd like to give these out to our podcast listeners.
It sounds so you were doing Margerkin and Rawlings thing?
Yeah, we do this riff that we've done it twice now. And there's some talk about possibly taking it on the road where we go to a venue and they book us and we introduce ourselves and Shanna starts with one of her songs. And then I find something in something I've written that relates to some of her songs and that to whatever she sang immediately before me. And then while I'm doing that, she's thinking of song, I'm thinking of something I've written that relates to the song. It's a very exhausting, exhilarating experience. It's very challenging. It was an hour and a half of this, and neither of us know. Shanna knows the first song she's going to sing. That's it. And it's just like, it's like Florida improv almost.
That sounds cool.
It was fun. So we did it all around Margerkin and Rawlings. And yeah, if we actually do take it on the road, we may have a sponsor for that. I will let you know. We don't actually have a guest next week, so we maybe can talk about visiting St. Augustine. Can we do a travel guide to St. Augustine?
Always.
And let's do that next week. And with that, folks, we're going to go, and we will catch you next time on the Florida Spectacular. Thanks for listening.
Thanks. Bye.